session number 27237, Reel 11.
Dr. Robert Nowarski, Reel 11. We were talking about as the advance began, through Falaise and then through on into Belgium and indeed into Holland before it all stalled again. What do you remember of this phase? You know.
Well, that actually went quite quickly because once they started going, once they broke through the once the Allies broke through the main German defences there, the advance was quite swift, actually. It felt that you almost couldn't keep up with the in your aeroplanes with the advance. And then again, all we did was trap the fleeing troops, you see. Then again, they defended themselves, you see, but there's no... That part of the thing, I remember, we didn't have all that many casualties by that time. When the main sort of breakout occurred, you see, and we are just more or less like a roller coaster towards Belgium, you see. Until we did actually come to Belgium, we were stationed in at an aerodrome in Ghent, which is supposed to be a city of 1,000 churches. It's certainly a church in every street, you see there. And we were there. That was a former German aerodrome anyway, so we were then stationed quite in the officers' mess. There was no... And from there, then, well... We were just again from that time on. We're on the actual activity that we were again strafing the fleeing troops, you see, or German positions when they were being entrenched around the sort of Holland border. Near Antwerp, I suppose, and bombing and strafing through enemy transport and trains. Actually, I remember now.
What do you remember of attacks on trains? So you talked about attacks earlier. That's yes, much earlier. No, is this another?
We were told actually to attack any train that would be moving, you see, but they were not. Mainly with just machine guns and your cannons, you see. And when it came to attacking trains, you attacked the locomotives that would. Once you disabled that, we couldn't move. So that's what you were talking about.
And were you successful?
Yes. Because the locomotives were quite easy. Well, they're big targets anyway. And they're quite easy to hit. And once you hit it, well, you could see the steel going out of them, out of the bellies, you see. And there was no... The train had to stop, and that was not.
Would you then strap the rest of the train?
Then you said strap the rest of the train, you see, because there was... They were always, or the vast majority of trains, they would have no civilian passengers in them. You see, they would be moving troops. You see, so they didn't.
Now you then had an interlude, where you seem to have gone back.
Yes.
Now, can you explain what unit? It doesn't say in your notes where you were seconded to a unit at Tangmere.
Yes.
Now, do you know which unit it was?
Yes. No, that was Central Fighter Establishment. That's what it was called. And I was there. I was only there for a very short time.
Seems to have been, well, about 2 months.
Yes, yes, probably less than that, actually, yes. We were doing sort of experimental work, really. Mainly, one thing that we're comparing the performances of the different aircraft that were being used then, you see, the Mustangs and Spitfires and American aircraft as well.
Now, how did you, was this a comparative thing? I mean,
yes. Thunderbolts was another one that we flew there, and you went through a certain set lot of maneuvers. You see, so for you would start at 5,000 feet or so, and then you start diving in. You would start diving in at a shallow dive, say with the at say 10-15 degrees. You see, with the other aircraft you were comparing side beside you. You see the. And then you could see whether he was actually gaining on you, or this, and then after one flight, you would then swap. He would be flying a Spitfire, and you would be flying the Thunderbolt. You see, there. And then the same again to eliminate pilot error. You see, there. And we're also testing new petrol. Actually,
now we'll come back to that. What do you remember of the results of your flights? We'll come back to the petrol. Do you remember how various planes did? Or
yes.
Or which was the best?
Well, I remember that when it came to between the Mustang and the Spitfire. Now, the Mustang would accelerate quicker in a dive. But in actual combat, the Spitfire was quite a bit better when it came to actual wheeling and turning and Spitfire was better there at that, you see.
This is a Spitfire 9.
Oh, there are Spitfire 9. Yes, we have. And you could. So although he could get away from you, you would gather speed quickly, you see, quicker. So if he were in enemy hands, you see, you could get away from you. But you could not fly him when it came to when it came to actual combat, you see. And of course, we were doing petrol there as well.
Was there any other plane you did other than the Mustang and Spitfire, or was that just...
Well, Mustang, Spitfire, there was Thunderbolt. Was the American? That's just about all.
What did you think of the Thunderbolt?
It was much heavier, actually, to fly than Spitfire or a Mustang. But if it came to sort of preference for my own flying, I would be much happier in a Spit. I would be happiest in a Spitfire.
Now, is that
and then in a Mustang, and then in a Thunderbolt.
So it was your least favourite. What about, was it not some truth in the fact you were used to the Spitfire? I mean, you've been flying it 4 years.
There could be, yes. But not only that, because once you sat in the aircraft, started flying it, it didn't take all that long to get to grips with the actual performance and what it can do, what it can't do, you see.
So as far you thought it was a genuine preference based on
Yes.
Now what was this petrol business? What were you doing?
At that time, I think the first time that they had the 100-octane petrol came in. And you could actually feel that the performance was quite a bit enhanced. You could get the engines; they seem to have more poke in them. You see, it was quite a.
Is this a higher octane? I'm not quite sure.
Yes, higher octane. Yeah, but we were told it's 100 octane. You see, well, I would have thought and that's what we are told, you see, that we, that's what we were testing, you see, there. But it certainly made quite a bit of difference. Well, you could see the difference, actually. You could feel the difference in the actual engine response, you see, and the engine power, I suppose, really. You could feel it, that you had more power at your disposal than you would have had with the original petrol.
Did you start using this petrol when you got back?
I don't know, because that was only an experimental sort of thing, you see. Whether they started using it or not, I expect they probably did later on. But that was, the war was actually finishing by that time anyway. It was not all that much.
Anything else about your time at the Central Fighter Establishment?
Yes, there was another thing, is we were using species of anti-blackout suits.
What are they?
That actually was, is you just had a pair of trousers up to about your waist. It was actually... to see how much G force you could withstand, and what happened there was in that normally with G force, you see, when you suddenly pull out from the thing, you see, now you will black out, because all the blood from the, say, from your head, from your brain drains, you see, usually to your extremities, you see, this, your legs, you see, now. So when you wore to special trousers, you see, now as you started you dive, and the more G force was being created, the air pressure inside the trousers would increase, so it would sort of squeeze you, you see, so there would be no, you couldn't, it was called, actually later it was called the G suit. Now, it made quite a bit of difference, because normally you would be blacking out at about 4.5 G's. That would be, you could see that you couldn't see anymore. You see, you drop it now. With the suit on, you could go up to about 9 G's.
Blackouts, would they last long?
Well, no. You made sure it didn't last long. You see, you could see that you couldn't. Your eyelids were very, very, very much, very much heavier, and you could see that you couldn't see anymore. Well, you just released, you just stopped, you see.
Now, when you were flying, did you ever black out while you were actually diving and flying in action?
No. You would always avoid it anyway. You see, you knew it would happen. Yes, you knew what would happen. Yes.
Now, what about? Any other things you did at?
Well, that's just about all we did, actually, because we did the G-suits and the petrol, you see, and the performances.
It's quite a lot. I mean, you were only there.
I was only for a few months. I think at the most, I probably.
Now you then went back to.
I went back to 302 again. You see there.
And
302 was still at Ghent. They were still at Ghent, actually. Yes, that was.
And you joined them in December, before Christmas?
Yes, that's right, yeah, yes. And I was very glad to be back again, you see, with your old pals, you see.
And the unit changed much in 2 months, I mean, personnel?
Well, we had few new pilots there as well, yes. But that was just about the end of the war, or nearly the end of the war. There was not...
Well, there's about 4 months left. But do you remember much about the last 4 months?
Well, the only thing I remember, actually, that we was following the armies, and it was mainly strafing and again bomber escorts that were bombers that were bombing the. Supply lines that really thing, except for anti-aircraft fire. There was virtually, I don't remember actually having met any more German aircraft opposing us, German fighters. That was the Luftwaffe was virtually out of the sky by that time. And we just went on and on and on until we went into Germany, and then eventually the war.
When you moved into Germany, I mean, where were you based in Germany?
Well, on different aerodromes. I don't quite remember. The only one thing I remember was Gütersloh, but that was one of the last aerodromes that we were stationed in.
What sort of reception did you get from sort of the German civilians?
Well, we didn't see many civilians, you see, really, to be quite frank with you. It's not really, because you were at your aerodromes, yeah, there were no civilians there. Except so waiters and the officers' mess, you see, but you didn't really mix with them very much. They showed you food, and that was the end of it.
Now, one thing that was rather sad was that your best friend was killed. Can you talk to me a bit about your friend? Who was this best friend? Do you remember his name?
Yes, actually, his name actually was Szczerbiński.
What was he like?
Now, he was a very good friend of mine, actually.
What was he like, though?
He was a nice chap. He was actually a very good pianist. He always used to play the piano in the officers' mess, you see, for us. And, he was a nice chap, like sort of like sort of good friends, you see. We were virtually on the last operational flight over Lübeck, where he was hit by anti-aircraft fire, and he must have been killed because he never got out.
Did you see it happen, or I mean, were you there?
I didn't see it happen itself. I just saw that an aircraft was spiraling down. You see, and nothing very much happened. We didn't know who it was until we landed. You see, and then we realized that was him actually. The sad part about it was actually that was virtually the last operational flight of the squadron in that war, and the war finished next day.
Did that make it worse somehow?
It did make it worse actually for you. Yes, he would have been finished sort of in that sort of manner. You see that another day and he would have been all right like the rest of us.
Had he been flying long? I mean, was he a long-standing member of the squadron?
Oh, yes. He must have been flying operation at least as much as I was, but in different squadrons, you see, at that particular time that we were in the same squadron.
Now, what about the VE Day, and how did you feel? I mean, or did that cast a cloud on it? What did you feel at the end of the war in Europe, 8th of May?
You were, of course, elated, you see, that this has at last finished. And there was and you also felt that sort of, you felt sorry for the Germans too, actually. Because when you saw the devastation of the destruction of Germany as it was, well, especially, I remember Hamburg was, and that was awful, actually. There was virtually just the, when you went through Hamburg, you thought that it looked quite all right, all the buildings were there. Until I had a closer look, and then you found that it's only the outside shells were in, and all the middle of it was all gone. It was all sort of, there was just a pile of rubble in the middle, but nothing So if it was a three or four story building, you see, there's no stuff. They're just the outside walls where they would do. With the remains of the window, or the, that, but there was no inside. You see, it was all squashed, and that really was it was a terrible sight. You could realize that how many there must have been, thousands and thousands and thousands of people that must have died to stay there, in that sort of last stages of the war. You see, and that was just one city. You see, and it made quite an impact on me. But then again, you said, well, they brought it on themselves.
Now, what happened to you and your squadron? I mean, you seem to, you were...
Well, we were just doing some training flights again, you see. Because we didn't know what was going to happen. And we thought that at the time that we might be even sent to the Far East, you see.
How did you feel about that?
I mean, well, you would have taken it so in your stride, I would have thought. You see, there's no... because although the war has finished here, you see, it was still going on in the Far East, you see. And so... And there was talk, actually, that we might, the squadrons might go there, you see. But actually, they probably would if it had it not been for the atomic bomb eventually, you see, and how it finished.
But you were perfectly willing to go if that's what happened?
Oh, yes, we would have gone, yes.
Now, where were you staying in Germany? I mean, do you remember where you're based? Or were you just in various places?
Actually, most of the time we were based near the name of the place. Near Hamburg, actually.
And that's where you stayed?
Yes, that's where you stayed, yes.
Did you get to meet more of the Germans, civilians?
We didn't meet very many German civilians.
Even after the war finished.
We were stationed near Hamburg, you know, but we were actually billeted out in houses which were requisitioned actually from the Germans, you see there. And, we would use about four or five officers to a house, you see there. But we would eat at the officers' mess.
And what was happening during this period? I mean, how long did it go on?
Well, it just went on and on, really. I was in Germany actually for quite a while after the war. I had a secondment actually from 302 Squadron to the Fuhlsbüttel aerodrome, which was again outside Hamburg.
The which aerodrome? Which aerodrome?
Fuhlsbüttel. Now, and that was a unit where we had German Air Force prisoners of war, or the Luftwaffe, mechanics. They were renovating, the German transport aircraft, which is Ju-52s, Junkers 52s, you see. That was the pre-war German airliner, as you would call it. And they were refurbishing them, and then we would test fly them, and then fly them to different capitals of Europe as war reparations, you see. We took them to Paris and Oslo and Stockholm. And Belfast, mainly. So and when we took them there, most of them actually to Belfast, where Short Brothers would refurbish the insides to make it make them into a into airliners again. You see, and that was quite interesting actually, because we. So having flown a Spitfire, single, very small aircraft, and that was a pretty great big thing, you see, with three engines, and quite a different sort of thing to fly. You see,
what was
very
it like
very
to fly?
Safe to fly, very safe, very safe, but very slow, and you were very safe to fly anyway. Yeah. I'll have to go up. Only a couple of seconds.
Were you on your own flying them? I mean, or would you have a co-pilot?
No,
and the rest
you
of
had
the crew?
To. You had to have a co-pilot. Then you could fly by yourself. It was too big, and for instance, if you had to, you know, it was fixed on the carriage, but you had to use flaps for landing and for takeoff. Now, and they would have to be operated by your co-pilot. You couldn't do it yourself. They were on the other side of the cockpit. You see them really. And so he would be sitting there, you see, there, operate the flaps, you see. There. But otherwise, it was actually quite good fun, actually, you see it out there.
And then what after that secondment, what happened then? After that secondment, what happened then? What did you do next?
I was there for quite some time actually, but then came 1946. I must have been there virtually through for a long time into 1946, where eventually this squadron was sent back to England, and we flew back
Remember when in 1946?
Yes. I'm not quite certain about the date, you see, but it was sometime in the mid-46, I suppose, where the whole squadron went back. I think it was Courtishall or somewhere where the squadron was disbanded. And we then took the aircraft themselves. I remember I took my Spitfire to Bryce Norton, where that was a sort of aerodrome where they had a lot of Spitfires there. I think that was the receiving depot for Spitfires, and to be turned into pots and pans eventually, I suppose, really. And I was told, all right, I could have bought my own Spitfire there for £50, but of course I didn't have £50. And in any case, even if I did buy it, where could I keep it? You see, you couldn't keep it in your back garden. You would have to be if you were a farmer and you had a lot of land, and so well, you could curb, I suppose, really, but not with that I was, as much as I was of.
And were you demobilised then?
Yes. No, I wasn't quite demobilised yet. You see, no.